The Phoenix Fire Department has done more mountain rescues so far this year than last. Not all are because of the triple-digit temperatures, but some are.
We have an elevated risk of heat-related illness and death from May through September. If you're going outside for an extended period anytime during those 5 months, you're putting yourself at risk.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, mapping high school graduation rates by district. The Mesa Police Department gets a new set of eyes in the sky, but do they need them?
As crowdfunding becomes more popular, what are the risks of giving your money to someone who asks for it online?
And ice cream celebrates its special day, but how out there is too out there when it comes to flavors?
I think as long as it tastes good to us, it's not too out there.
Plus, we look for a sense of place and tour a former military airfield.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. 149 people have been rescued during mountain hikes by Phoenix fire officials so far this year. It's summer here in the valley, so that means it's really hot over every inch every afternoon. So for their own good, should walkers, joggers, and hikers be prevented from using valley parks and peaks when we reach a certain temperature? Or should there be a so-called stupid hiker law, where a stranded hiker has to pay for the cost of being rescued? Ben Ruddle is an associate professor at ASU's Fulton School of Engineering. Ben, how does the heat affect us on an everyday basis? And that's even if we don't spend much time outside. Let's say a person works downtown, might leave the office to just walk to lunch for a few minutes.
If you're exposed to temperatures that are 5, 10 degrees higher, even a little bit higher, day in, day out, even if it's in short pieces of time, 10 minutes here or there, it's going to put a chronic and cumulative stress on your body. And that's going to add up. Your body has to expend energy, and it puts stress on your body in order to get rid of all that heat. So it strains your system, and that strain can translate itself into illness and even death.
Some people who've lived here for a significant amount of time and have gone through multiple summers will probably think to themselves that, you know, as long as I have my air conditioning on a little bit, as long as I'm not spending too much time outside, once I decide to actually be outside for a while, whether it's doing yard work or playing tennis or taking a hike, I'm in pretty good shape here because I'm more used to it. Does one person have, for lack of a better term, an advantage to be able to deal with the conditions?
Yes. There are large differences. We do acclimate to our environment as people. And that's due to a combination of physical acclimation with our bodies and our mental attitude also. But it also has to do with the way that we build our cities and we live our lives. So there's a concept called minimum mortality temperature, which is a scientific way of saying this is the temperature at which people are the healthiest, the most comfortable, and least likely to get sick and die. We have one of the highest minimum mortality temperatures in the world, which means that we're acclimated fairly well. All that air conditioning, the way that we dress, the way that we live, it does help us to cope with the heat. But there are limits to that. The research is showing that above about 90 degrees, somewhere between 90 and 100, we start to see an exponential increase in your heat risk. And so by the time those temperatures get up to, for example, 112 degrees, according to our research, it's now likely on a day like that with a maximum temperature of 112 or above that at least one person is going to die in the metro area on that day from direct heat-related causes.
Some people have floated the idea that certain times of day, if it gets above 106 degrees or if it's between noon and 5 in the afternoon or something like that on a typical summer day, that parks and whatnot should be restricted. Does that make sense to you? Are there other alternatives that perhaps maybe could be put into place that aren't quite as extreme as some would say in that case?
I don't think that a blanket policy limiting access to our natural resources is appropriate. I think we need something that is much more educationally oriented to make sure that people understand the risks and the sort of situation they're getting themselves into. I think it's important that people know when they get on that trailhead what time of year it is. They might not know if they're from out of state that June is an extremely dangerous time of year. So in fact, we have an elevated risk of heat-related illness and death in the Phoenix metro area and surroundings from May through September. If you're going outside for an extended period anytime during those 5 months, you're putting yourself at risk. And during those three peak summer months of June, July, and August, we often have what you would call an excessive or extreme risk. My recommendation for policy would be that we use signage. Mm-hmm. I think it might be smart to use a version of what the National Forest Service does with their fire warning system, perhaps a tiered level that says if you're in the months of October through April, you're in the green, no elevated risk mm-hmm. of heat. Maybe in May and September, you're in the orange, you have a risk. And if you're going in those three peak summer months, June, July, August, you would be in the red. And you'd have specific precautions that would be recommended. We need similar sorts of targeted efforts around workplaces where there's outdoor work going on, schools, and other types of outdoor activities. So my recommendation is that anyone organizing a workplace or an outdoor activity needs to understand the risk of heat and develop an informed opinion and policy for how they should deal with it.
Ben Ruddle is an associate professor at ASU's Fulton School of Engineering. In the Twin Cities of Colorado City, Arizona, and Hilldale, Utah, some members of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or FLDS, are being evicted from their homes. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry spoke with a reporter who's been covering this, and she's with me now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Steve.
So why is it that people are being evicted at all?
Well, there's a trust called the United Effort Plan, or UEP, and the UEP used to be operated by the FLDS Church and is now controlled by the state. And it's imposed fees of $100 a month to households in the community, and some people are refusing to pay. Then in June of last year, a judge said that she wanted eviction proceedings to begin. The first notices were served nearly a year ago, but in the last month or two, we've seen a lot more. And I talked about this with Cami Jim. She's a reporter and editor for the St. George News, and she's based in Northern Arizona.
By and large, those who are refusing to pay these fees are people who are current members of the FLDS Church. And what we've been told is basically the FLDS Church has forbidden them to work with the UEP at all. And even going so far as creating a committee of FLDS members whose job it was to go around to these homes and remove the eviction notices, remove the informational notices from the doors of these homes so that the residents would not even have a glimpse of what they were saying. So basically, members of the FLDS Church have been told not to work with the UEP, and we've been told that if they're caught working with UEP, that they would essentially get kicked out of the FLDS Church. And interestingly, what the city has done in Hilldale is last year they rezoned a commercial area in Hilldale and constructed a tent city for the FLDS members who were being evicted from their homes.
So I understand that there's been some retaliation, actually, against the county constable who's been going door to door along with a member of the UEP to actually evict people from their homes.
Yes, and actually, on a broader scale, many, many former FLDS people in the community or people who don't belong to the church have said that they've experienced all different kinds of persecution from the FLDS people, things from, you know, cars going by and people throwing water bottles and hitting them in the head, vandalizing their property, spinning up gravel with their tires at people, you know, and well, we were told during this last round of evictions that when the constable was there, the constable and somebody who works for the UEP, that a woman tried to run the constable down with her car as the eviction was taking place. And this UEP worker said that he's had his tires slashed multiple times just in the past month. The way that the FLDS members view the UEP and the government at large is just the FLDS people are being persecuted by them, is how they see it.
So obviously this is a really complicated situation that's been ongoing for quite some time. Is there an expectation about how much longer these evictions will take or what kind of an outcome we could expect?
That I'm not sure about. I know that there has been, at the same time, that there's been somewhat of a migration of FLDS people to an extent leaving this area and going elsewhere. There's been an influx of people who used to live in the community, used to be members of the FLDS Church, and either left or were kicked out of the church, slowly coming back and working with the UEP to get these homes and take up residence in these homes. And it's been a power struggle for sure in the community.
That was Cammie Jim. She's a reporter and editor for the St. George News, and she's based in Northern Arizona.
KJZZ's Sarah Ventry, thanks so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
Sorry, kids, but it'll be back to school time in Arizona, and sooner than you might think in some places. Under Chandler's modified schedule, teachers and students will be among the first in the valley to return from summer break on Monday. But the question that looms over classrooms all over the state is, will there be enough teachers to fill them with quality educators? KJZZ's Phil Latzman joins me to tell us why there is serious concern.
Well, Mark, the Arizona Department of Education reports that over the past 5 years, thousands of teachers have left the state for greener pastures. According to U.S. Census figures, Arizona is close to the bottom of the list of states when it comes to spending per student. Here, the average figures out to about $7,200 per student per year. The national average is $10,700. So that's a significant drop, and it translates directly into teacher salaries. And for more on that, I spoke with Tracy Benson, who is Associate Executive Director of the Arizona School Boards Association, a nonprofit that tracks the progress of teachers and students across the state about this serious shortage of educators.
There are far too many classrooms in Arizona that aren't going to have a full-time teacher in front of them when school starts in a few weeks. Not only are we experiencing shortages in rural and remote Arizona, where that has been the case for some time, but now in many of our urban areas, we're also experiencing an extreme teacher shortage. It really varies from district to district, but there have been reports that going into this coming school year, there may be more than 1,000 openings in schools in Maricopa County alone. And we know from research that's been done over the past year that there have been a significant number of classrooms that have had no full-time teacher in front of them for a full year.
And what happens when there's no full-time teacher there?
Well, you know, the quality and experience of substitutes really varies, as you might expect. We've seen a lot of creative solutions in our school districts where teams of teachers will work together to integrate students who don't have a full-time teacher in front of them into their own classrooms and teaching and learning opportunities. So that's been a good thing. But student learning does suffer when there is either a temporary absence of a teacher at the start of a school year where hiring still is taking place, or when that goes for months into the school year.
The average teacher's salary in the state in 2013 was around $50,000 a year. That's low compared to some other neighboring states, so California, which is near 70, Nevada, which is 55, and Oregon, which is 57. Is that part of the problem? Is that part of the reason why the state cannot attract the teachers it needs to run classrooms?
Absolutely. We know from research and surveys of teachers that salary is definitely an issue. And while that's the average salary, the starting salary for Arizona teachers hovers around $30,000 a year, which is very, very low and doesn't even compare in some cases to careers and professions that don't require a college degree.
What are local school districts in Maricopa County and throughout the valley and the state, for that matter, doing to address this shortage as we approach the school year?
School districts are actively recruiting teachers from within Arizona. Some of them are going out of state to try to recruit teachers and bring them in to start their careers here in Arizona. But that's the short-term effort. What we really need to be focused on is how do we build this pipeline over the long term? What kind of solutions can we put in place from a policy point of view, from a workplace point of view, that are going to attract these teachers in the first place and encourage high school students to major in education in college and become teachers?
And that is Tracy Benson with the Arizona School Boards Association on what's being described as a critical teacher shortage in our state and region. This isn't happening everywhere, but if it is in your part of the state, we'd love to hear from you as classrooms start to repopulate this summer. You can track us down on Twitter at KJZZPhoenix and use the hashtag AZTeachersShortage.
That's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. Phil, thanks.
Thank you, Mark.
The federal government requires school districts across the country to use a uniform calculation to determine graduation rates. But until now, that data had generally been reported on a state-by-state basis. That changed when Sarah Butrymovich mapped graduation rates for the 2012-13 school year across the country by district. She's data editor at Hechinger Report, a nonprofit education news outlet.
There's definitely regional differences across the country. For instance, the Southeast tends to have a lot lower graduation rates, whereas the middle of the country, the Midwest, is doing a little bit better. And there's also a lot of states like Arizona where there's pretty significant variation within the state, and that's what's masked when the government only releases these statewide averages.
So what kinds of differences did you see in different parts of the state here?
In Arizona, I mean, just to give you an idea, your graduation rates range from 100% to 33%, so there's a lot of variation. And the statewide graduation rate is 75%, so there are more, you know, sort of on the lower end of the spectrum from what I was looking at. But, you know, you can see pretty clearly across the northern part of the state, basically anything bordering Utah and Nevada has a graduation rate lower than 75%. Most of the Navajo reservation is included in that. And then once you get a little further south in the state, you start to see districts with some higher graduation rates popping up, but it's somewhat sporadic. Most of the higher performers are kind of isolated.
Yeah, which ones did do well? I mean, what part of the state, and was there anything sort of, were there any themes sort of those districts where the schools did particularly well?
So there's a cluster in the very southeast corner of the state. I think it's St. David, Tombstone, and Union Valley, where you see basically more than two higher performing districts with graduation rates over 90% together. That's the only place you see that in the state. But then there's also Joseph City is one of those places with 100% graduation rate that I was talking about before.
What did you find in the Phoenix metro area?
So in the metro area, Phoenix itself had about a 74% graduation rate. And then as you sort of get in to the wider area, the graduation rates start to bump up slightly. Immediately to the west, it's only a little bit higher. And then as you get a little further west, it keeps going up. North of Phoenix had more significant differences than the west or the east did. Those districts tended to do a little better. So you see sort of this urban core ringed by districts that are doing better and having higher rates sort of bleeding out from that. I think that's a pretty common theme that I'm seeing across urban areas. You know, it's the same thing in Chicago and Boston. So with that, Phoenix sort of fits right into what you'd expect.
One of the things that struck me looking at the map was, and it was color-coded by sort of the percentage of high school graduation, and basically the entire perimeter of Arizona, pretty much, was on the lower end, that sort of lighter mm-hmm. green color. And then there were some darker colors, which meant better rates sort of as you got in more toward the interior of the state. Is that something that you found in other states, or is that unique to Arizona?
Pretty unique to Arizona. You know, a lot of other states, you could see sort of the boundaries between other states, but it wasn't necessarily so stark, and it all kind of shifted together. Or districts that just were completely across the board doing really poorly, and green was the color for under 75%. So just states where districts were, you know, all some shade of green. And again, that's one of the reasons we wanted to do this, is because you get these states where it's really hard to explain exactly what's happening in Arizona. There's some geographic pattern, and then there's a lot of sporadic differences between the districts.
Sarah Butrymovich is data editor at Hechinger Report, a nonprofit education news outlet. Still to come, finding a sense of place in the middle of the city.
This is a place of convergence. If you look out over the porch area of the post office, you can see many of the new modern office buildings, but at the same time, a bit of historic Phoenix.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. A flash flood watch in effect for the Valley starting at 5 o'clock this afternoon. That'll extend through tomorrow night. Currently just partly cloudy skies and 101 degrees. Quick check of Valley traffic. An accident I-10 westbound at 7th Street blocking the shoulder. Also the 60 westbound at the 101. It's 2:25.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore of Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership featuring the all-new 2016 Outback, 33 mpg fuel efficiency and built for your active lifestyle. Ready now for test drives. Shop Subaru.com.
The leaders of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea were at the United Nations in New York in the past week, hoping to raise more than $3 billion to help them recover from the effects of Ebola. Apart from claiming more than 11,000 lives, the outbreak has seriously weakened health systems. The BBC's Anne Soy has been there to see how Liberia has been affected.
I'm standing in the middle of a busy street in Monrovia, right next to Redemption Hospital. This hospital played a critical role during the peak of the Ebola outbreak, and as a result, lost at least 12 health workers, including its head surgeon. Right now, in front of the hospital, there's an extension that has been created. There's a man standing in protective clothing. He's wearing rubber boots, a waterproof apron, gloves, and a clear face mask. He's spraying chlorinated water on the soles of shoes of everyone getting into the hospital. This is the standard procedure now.
We don't take chances.
Dr. Nwai Gobudolo is an obstetrician here. She worked here through the crisis.
We are supposed to treat non-Ebola cases here, and we don't want Ebola coming in. We have mothers and we have infants.
And also you need to take care of the health workers here.
Before we do delivery, everyone has to dress in a full PPE, okay?
Like you're treating an Ebola patient.
Yes, and we have our sprayer who will spray afterwards.
Now what? Separation. Okay, we'll demonstrate that. Okay, delivery of the what? Yes. Placenta. Thank you. Now, deliver.
A lesson on delivery at the Tabban National Institute of Medical Arts. A new generation of midwives is being prepared. Liberia had a serious shortage of health workers even before the outbreak. And then many contracted Ebola and died, more than 500 in all the affected countries. Dr. Banis Dan, the health minister, says there's an urgent need to increase the workforce.
Our plan is to scale up the community health workforce to be able to do the health promotion, but to also be able to dispense and treat some minor illnesses, especially malaria, for example, which is the predominant reason why someone will go to a health facility. That can be done, tested, and treated at a community level. The package is also to bring in some foreign medical practitioners. We are giving priority to Liberians to pull them back home if they are willing to come and help.
The Ebola outbreak has forced Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea to reevaluate their health systems. Their leaders are in New York to raise funds for recovery. The World Health Organization's representative in Liberia, Dr. Alex Gasasira, exudes confidence in their plans.
We had people from East and Central Africa that have had repeated Ebola outbreaks share with us what they did with minimal resources to ensure that when a new outbreak comes, it is timely detected and responded to immediately.
So are you confident that it can be done?
We are on the right track. I'm confident we have very strong political leadership and support from the government of Liberia. We have a lot of generous support from the international community. I think we have good strategies that have proven successful in other countries. So I'm confident that it can be done.
Donors have already made substantial financial commitments, but the real test will be whether these plans succeed, and if they do, whether the benefits will trickle down to those that need them most.
That's the BBC's Anne Soy.
When you think about the Valley, is there a specific place you think of, a place that exemplifies your image of our desert home? That's a question we're posing in a new occasional series we're calling In a Place. We'll be asking architects about what gives them a sense of place for the Valley. We start with Diane Jacobs. She's an architect with Holly Street Studio in Phoenix.
Today we're on the back porch or the former loading dock of the Federal Post Office building, which is located at Fillmore and Central Avenue in downtown Phoenix.
So we're right across the street from the ASU downtown campus. This has been turned into a student center for ASU downtown. Can you sort of describe what it is? We're sitting underneath underneath a roof here. What are we looking at?
Well, what we see as we look straight south is the Civic Space Park. And surrounding us is the overhang of the old loading dock, which was formerly the back end of the Federal Post Office. And it's sort of industrial in nature, but has been rehabilitated to open up into a large gathering space that is adjacent to the post office lobby.
This was a project that you and your company worked on. As you were designing it, what were you hoping to achieve with this spot?
Well, the most important thing was to sort of revive an existing building and make it useful to the general public, in particular the students of the downtown campus of ASU. And so what we were hoping to do was keep the original architecture intact and tell the story about what it once was, which was a very important public building during its time, but to slightly transform it and adapt it to today's needs of students who need to find places to study, plug in many cases, but mostly have a home base in a brand new campus environment.
So what is it about this spot that gives you a sense of place for Phoenix?
Well, growing up in larger, more dense cities in different places around the world gave me an appreciation for public space. I think what's important is that public space is something that every individual might find and see as valuable. We can be alone, but sort of connected, and we can be part of larger things. This is a place of convergence. If you look out over the porch area of the post office, you can see many of the new modern office buildings, but at the same time, a bit of historic Phoenix with the old hotels and the old housing towers. And you also see the beautiful sculpture by Janet Ekman, sort of representing kind of a new wave of kind of public spaces in Phoenix.
Do you ever come down here? I mean, your office is just a couple blocks north of here. Do you ever come down and check out how people are using it, if people are using the space?
Yes. One of the most exciting things was a couple years ago when the project was under construction, and we actually were sitting in one of the new restaurants that ASU sort of helped create, and we saw students changing classes. And compared to about 10 years ago, the place has transformed so dramatically.
One of the things that's so interesting to me about this space is that its former use was very utilitarian. It was basically one job, and that was as a loading dock. And now, the way you're describing it, so many different things could happen here, one of which is just sort of sitting and relaxing and not doing anything. It seems like such an interesting juxtaposition between its former use and its current use.
Well, you know, some of the most exciting spaces were formerly utilitarian spaces, and that the only thing that's sort of surrounding the experience are kind of structural elements and parts and pieces of an existing building. But generally speaking, it sort of steps out of the way. So the loading dock, by necessity, had to have large openings and a big overhang and sort of a direct connection to the building. So some of these utility spaces are the best places to adapt. We love taking care of old buildings and watching them transform into so many other things.
Diane Jacobs is an architect with the Phoenix firm Holly Street Studio. We met on what used to be the loading dock of the former post office, now student center for ASU downtown on Central and Fillmore. Let us know what spot gives you a sense of place for the Valley. Email us at theshow@kjzz.org or tweet at us at @KJZZPhoenix using the hashtag KJZZInAPlace. Recently, the City of Mesa Police Department purchased a new helicopter for more than $3 million to replace an aging helicopter that was damaged after crash landing in Gilbert last year. The citizens of Mesa approved the purchase in a bond election after the police department argued that maintaining a Sky Patrol unit is a costly but necessary tool for their work. But KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins wondered if there's a less costly alternative as drone technology permeates our lives and the skies. Hey, Jimmy.
Hey, Mark, you know, lots of industries like agriculture and, of course, the Department of Defense are turning away from manned flight and looking to more cost-effective drones. So I spoke with Detective Steve Berry. He's a 20-year veteran of the Mesa Police Department and served in the Sky Patrol unit for 7 years. He said despite the initial price and substantial maintenance cost, there's just no substitute for having human eyes in the sky.
The men and women of the air unit, they fly a patrol-type function. Think of them as a flying patrol car. They just don't get out and actually put hands on people to make their arrests, but they certainly do everything that they can to direct the ground officers, perhaps to a suspect or a missing child or whatever, actually.
And they're already in the air, right? They're not responding to a call, but they're actually flying shifts?
In most cases, the helicopter would already be in the air. Our average response time, last time I looked, was approximately 45 seconds or so. Now, granted, there are times where it may take us 2 or 3 minutes to get all the way across town. You know, you don't think about it when you're a patrol officer, oftentimes on the ground, we're all responsible for a beat, a specific area. And when you're in the air unit, you're responsible for 150 square miles. So it certainly changes your perspective from there. But if the crew were on the ground and they had to go out, strap in, start the aircraft, get clearance from the tower out at Falcon Field where we fly, and then respond to a call, you're probably looking at a 10 to 15 minute ETA versus a 2 or 3 minute ETA.
So you did this for years. What's an example of a typical call?
A typical call in aviation is much like the rest of police work. It could be almost anything. But for us, the primary thing, again, being patrol support, is to be the eyes from above that the officers can't see. Officers driving down our normal roadways, say there's a burglary going on behind a business, they may be looking and scanning the fronts, but they would have to drive all the way around those buildings to see the backs. We're able to see that very easily from the sky. And certainly at night and as it gets later and into the wee morning hours, things stick out pretty prevalently. If there's a vehicle tucked in behind when you can see where somebody's got their foot on the brake, it really stands out in the middle of the night when there's everything's closed and nothing else around.
Are you by yourself or are you working in a team?
It is always a crew of two. There's always a pilot and a tactical flight officer. The pilot's primary responsibility is to fly the aircraft and talk to the control towers and things of that nature. And the TFO for the night, who in most cases is also a pilot as well, is responsible for talking on the police radios, running the mapping system, spotlights, all of those things.
Are you ever recording, taking pictures or video, or are you just making observations?
In most cases, it's observations. We do have the ability to record some things, depending upon the day and what equipment is in or on the aircraft. But on a general all-day-long basis, no, we're not recording.
We're in an era now of drones. There's drones everywhere. And it made me wonder why is it still necessary to maintain helicopter fleets when it seems like we have an increasing capability to monitor the skies with other means?
Right now, I would describe that as very similar to a lot of things. It's very tough to take that human element out of it. A drone in the sky absolutely can fly and see and all of those things, but it's so hard to have that 360-degree worldview from a drone if you were sitting in some place like this, like in a studio, watching screens. Whereas when you have a police officer, and everyone who's in our air unit is a police officer, up there and thinking about the call as it's unfolding and looking at what could be ahead and what's next and where a bad guy might go, it's very tough to remove that tangible from it. And we find that it's a far better use of resources, even though it's an expensive resource, to have actual manned aircraft at this point to do that police work. Everyone knows that running an air unit is an expensive proposition, but when you have significant incidents take place and that aircraft is there to handle those, you very quickly find the benefit that's there.
Well, Detective Berry, thank you very much for your time today.
Oh, absolutely. Glad to be here.
That was KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins speaking with Detective Steve Berry of the Mesa Police Department.
Coming up, a Phoenix couple looks for alternative ways to fund the expansion of their family.
So we had this vision really just of having family and friends over for coffee, thinking of ways we could get people involved and do something fun based on the things we love.
Raising money for an adoption, one espresso at a time. That's ahead on the show. in Valley weather rather, later this afternoon, starting at 5, we'll have a flash flood watch in effect through tomorrow night. And then for tonight, there's a 60% chance for rain with lows in the mid-80s. Showers, possibly thunderstorms tomorrow. It'll be cooler with a high only expected to reach 93. Currently, relative humidity is at 24%. We're partly cloudy and 101 degrees. Meanwhile, on the Valley freeways, an accident on the 60 westbound at Dobson. There's also a collision just moved to the side of the road, I-10 westbound at I-17. It's the show at 2:40.
KJZZ is supported by The Persian Room, health-conscious Persian cuisine for lunch and dinner, plus catering for your special occasions and business events. The Persian Room on Scottsdale Road, one light north of Bell, 480-614-1414.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Tributes are being held for the four Marines killed in yesterday's shooting rampage at two military facilities in Chattanooga, Tennessee. The identities of the Marines have been released. Among them is 40-year-old Marine Gunnery Sergeant Thomas Sullivan of Springfield, Massachusetts. New England Public Radio's Sam Hudzik reports.
An aide to Mayor Dominic Sarno says he spoke to Sergeant Sullivan's family this morning. This follows an outpouring of condolence messages on the social media pages of Sullivan's siblings and the popular bar in town owned by his brother. Sullivan joined the Marines in 1997, and a report on MassLive.com says he served two tours in Iraq and earned a Purple Heart. Sullivan attended the local Catholic school, which posted on Facebook, "Our thoughts and prayers are with the Sullivan family and with those who called Thomas friend and brother." For NPR News, I'm Sam Hudzik in Springfield, Massachusetts.
President Obama held a conversation with Saudi Arabia's foreign minister today. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest says the leaders discussed the bilateral relationship between the two countries.
There was a discussion about how to further enhance that close and longstanding partnership. And I guess that will be the subject of some discussions that Secretary Carter will have with his counterparts when he visits Saudi Arabia next week.
The Saudi foreign minister also welcomed the nuclear agreement with Iran during the meeting. A top official of the governing body of international soccer has arrived in the U.S. to face racketeering and bribery charges. Prosecutors say Jeffrey Webb has been extradited from Switzerland. He's among seven FIFA officials detained there. The rest are fighting extradition. Stocks traded mixed today on Wall Street at the close. The Dow closed down 33 points. The Nasdaq up 46. The S&P 500 closed up 2 points. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
The Special Olympics World Games kick off next weekend in LA, and one of the teams taking part in the softball tournament is from Arizona. It's made up of 21 to 40-year-olds from across the state and will scrimmage tomorrow night in Peoria before leaving for California early next week. Amy Renfrey is the team's coach, although her day job is as IT director for the Phoenix Union High School District.
I played softball since I was a little girl, and I've also been coaching Special Olympics since I was probably around 14.
How do you get involved in Special Olympics?
I didn't want to take PE in high school, and they had a class called People, and they had a class of students, about 30 of us, and then we essentially taught PE to all the community skills students, which were the special ed students, and we kind of interacted half and half and played all the sports with them during their PE class. And then we also coached Special Olympics for them and traveled, and I loved it, and I've been doing it ever since.
So your team is made up entirely of athletes from Arizona.
Yeah, kind of like all-stars. There were 15 spots on the team, and there's four different divisions in Special Olympics softball. And so we picked the top two divisions, and we invited everybody in the state to come and try out. We had about 30 come, and we chose 15, but unfortunately one of them dropped out. So we have a team of 14, and they're from all over the state.
Have you coached in the Special Olympics games like this before?
Not this big. A couple of years ago, we went to a invitational tournament in Chicago. And that was a really big tournament. There was a lot of teams from the United States and Canada. So that was kind of big, but this is, you know, worldwide.
Are you nervous?
Yeah, a little bit. I'm pretty competitive, so I don't like to lose.
Do you think your athletes are nervous?
No, they're really excited.
What are they most excited about?
I think just playing in something this big, it's the biggest competition they'll ever be able to play in.
What is it about coaching these particular athletes that you seem to really enjoy?
I don't know. I have a pretty strong bond with all the athletes and their families and some of the people I've been coaching for like 20 years. But I don't know. I just love it. It's a lot of fun. And I tried coaching my daughter's teams when she was growing up, and I did not have patience for those teenage attitudes and stuff. So I just really enjoy it.
Do you have a sense of how good your team can be?
Yeah. I think we can compete up there with the top.
Maybe a gold medal?
I hope so.
What do you think it would mean for you and for your athletes if you actually do win the gold?
It will be amazing. It will be amazing. We've been working really hard for a year. So in Special Olympics Arizona, there's over 18,000 athletes. So for these 14 to compete this big, it's going to be a big deal.
Amy Renfrey is the IT director for the Phoenix Union High School District. She'll also be coaching the Special Olympics slow pitch softball team, the Arizona team, in the Special Olympics World Summer Games in Los Angeles. Amy, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Raising a lot of money, like tens of thousands of dollars, used to have to be done by going to a bank or having a wealthy relative. But the emergence, explosion even, of crowdfunding has offered many more options for grassroots efforts to bring in cash for projects. Ethan Mollick is an assistant professor of management at the Wharton School of Business.
Crowdfunding has been with us in some form for a very long time. When the Statue of Liberty was being erected in New York, it was actually funded by a campaign of collecting dollars from individual patrons. But what's taken off in the last 4 or 5 years has been this form of crowdfunding over the internet, and it really has progressed incredibly rapidly from essentially nothing in 2009 to billions of dollars today.
Is there a way to tell what percentage of people who get involved in crowdfunding are actually legitimately doing it because they think they have a worthwhile idea, they want to see if the public likes it, or should there be valid concern about this idea that some people are frankly just trying to take advantage of a situation? Maybe their idea wasn't that great to begin with, or maybe they're simply underhanded.
So I've spent a lot of time looking at reward-based crowdfunding, which has been the biggest sector here, and at least to date. And what I actually found is that fraud is remarkably low. So when I have done some studies, I found that less than 1% of the money going to crowdfunding goes to fraudulent campaigns. And it seems to be a very kind of rare phenomenon, which is interesting because, as you said, there's not necessarily a lot of controls that would prevent fraud from happening. So instead, it's the crowd itself that helps cut down on fraud.
Are there limits that you see to crowdfunding, perhaps some that are obvious and some that might be things to watch for as crowdfunding perhaps becomes even more common?
Sure. I mean, I think there's a sort of social piece, and then there's a sort of large-scale piece. So the social piece, I think there's always a danger of exhaustion, right? So you already have millions of people who've invested in crowdfunding campaigns. Most of them are thrilled. Some of them are disappointed. Do you start getting tired of getting too many campaigns from too many people and you start to roll your eyes, right? This is being like asked by Girl Scout cookies from too many friends whose children are doing Girl Scouts. And then I think the larger picture is, how do we get crowdfunding to work for areas where there may not be an immediate reward or immediate payoff? So there's already been some work on doing crowdfunding to help solve funding for disease research and other areas, but there's a lot of new frontiers out there still.
In so many industries, we've seen innovative smaller companies, as you mentioned, whether it's with venture capital or just takeovers, or decide, hey, we really want to buy that company. A major company buys a much smaller company thinking, we really want that innovative idea. Is there a possibility that crowdfunding sort of in general becomes absorbed by a larger sort of concept or larger company?
I trust the crowd somewhat. So the crowd actually has a pretty good eye for authenticity, and they're much less likely to kick money in to help a large for-profit corporation than they are a bunch of inventors from an online community they care about who are trying to solve a problem that they share. Now, that doesn't mean that crowdfunded projects don't get bought out. Oculus Rift, which is a virtual 3D goggles, was purchased by Facebook for about $2 billion a year or so ago. So, I mean, this stuff happens. But I think authenticity actually matters here. People support things that they care about, they feel a connection to. And I think if crowdfunding became entirely corporate, it wouldn't survive very long.
Ethan Mollick is an assistant professor of management at the Wharton School of Business.
Having a baby is expensive, with hospital costs alone usually in the high thousands for a childbirth without complications.
But you may not realize that a private adoption is often twice, sometimes even three or four times as expensive, and many potential adopters can't shoulder these high costs on their own.
The show's Annika Klein tells us about one couple who found it takes a village to adopt a child.
Jake and Rachel McDonald went through a traditional pregnancy when they had their daughter, Everly. Now, they want to bring another baby into the family, but this time, they're trying something new. Jake McDonald is a barista and says he thought, why not use his skill as a way to fundraise?
So we had this vision really just of having family and friends over for coffee, thinking of ways we could get people involved and do something fun based on the things we love.
They call it Adopted Coffee and open their home once a week to accept donations for coffee, tea, and pastries.
Two of those? Okay.
It's just one part of their effort to raise $40,000 to adopt a newborn baby. Tamara Shanker is an adoption attorney and says $40,000 is on the high end. But with a private adoption, the cost depends on the agency. Some are what Shanker calls one-stop shopping agencies.
They do all the background check. They do all the home studies. They locate birth mothers for the families.
On top of that, potential adopters might also have to pay for some living and medical expenses for the birth mother. And
if there's any complications with the birth, that can make the cost skyrocket.
State subsidies are available for those adopting within the state foster care system, but private adopters are on their own. And Shanker says most people she's worked with need more than just their savings.
Oh, I've seen the gamut. People have cashed in 401ks. Friends and family are donating. Credit cards get maxed out. Stocks, bonds. People get very creative.
Asking for donations is not uncommon. A quick search of the word adopt on the fundraising website GoFundMe.com yields more than 2,000 results, the McDonald's among them. But the 25 donors who contributed to their GoFundMe account pales in comparison to the hundreds of people who have stopped by their pop-up coffee house.
Thank you so much for coming out, guys.
The McDonald's raised more than $8,000 from Adopted Coffee in just over 2 months. Ben Martin is sipping a cup on the front porch, and he has a theory about why Adopted Coffee is getting so many donations.
I mean, you're in someone's house. Like, they're literally opening their doors and cooking you breakfast and making you a cup of coffee. And I think the fact that it's so much more personal probably encourages people to give more.
Besides providing drinks, the McDonald's have conversations with their visitors. Rachel McDonald says the coffee events have helped them explain to the community why they're adopting.
People that may not have the same beliefs as us or the same experience with adoption are able to understand it and ask questions in a very open atmosphere.
The McDonald's have a ways to go to reach their funding goal. But that big expense gets smaller the more it gets divided into espresso-sized parts. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
Good afternoon. With Mark, I'm Steve. Might be a wet weekend around the valley. A flash flood watch goes into effect tonight at 5 and will be in effect through tomorrow night. Currently partly cloudy skies and 101 degrees at 253.
KJZZ is supported by the Children's Museum of Phoenix, now offering preschool and primary art classes. Art classes information and registration at childrensmuseumofphoenix.org.
It's one of the most recognized business schools in the world, and it's right here in the Valley. But the facility had a different purpose during World War II. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez has more.
About 1,000 students are enrolled at Thunderbird School of Global Management in Glendale. Did you know Thunderbird School was originally a military aviation training base during World War II?
It was really American cadets who were, at that point, Army men who were interested in flying.
Shannon Walker is the archivist for the school.
And then later, the Chinese cadets came, and that program developed to train the Chinese cadets. And then British pilots came and trained here for a little while until Falcon Field opened up.
Thunderbird Field No. 1, as it was officially known, was created in 1941 on a square mile of what is today 59th Avenue and Greenway Road. Back then, that was open desert land, perfect for the hundreds of planes that were used to train future airmen.
They would come here for 10 weeks of training on a Stearman airplane. And the Stearman biplane is what they used at the time. If they passed, they would go on to more advanced training as a bomber, as a navigator, as a fighter pilot, different kinds of aircraft from there. This here is the control tower.
Walker shows me around the Thunderbird school. Some of the original structures still stand here today, more than 70 years later. The control tower has been restored. Some of the remaining barracks are used as office space and once served as student dorms. And the school's alumni center was the first structure built here. It is where the general's office and infirmary were. Today, it's called Founders Hall.
The barracks, some of them really do need a lot of help to be inhabitable at this point because they were built in 1941 and they weren't built to last. You know, they were built kind of for a temporary purpose. The last remaining building which we can walk to is the hangar. We can walk there.
Today, the hangar houses stacks of historical materials open to the public. The base closed in late 1945. Walker says it was left untouched for a few months until two Army Air Force colonels proposed creating a school to train people on foreign trade. It was to help build better international business relations with other countries after the war. It was the first school of its kind. The first class graduated in 1947, and most of those students were men on the GI Bill. Oh, if you want to see what the Thunderbird School property looked like during World War II, just watch the 1942 film Thunderbirds, Soldiers of the Air. It was filmed on the base. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
This Sunday may well be the tastiest holiday you didn't know existed. It's National Ice Cream Day. And just in case you think we or a couple of guys named Ben and Jerry made this up, it actually became an official holiday in 1984 when President Ronald Reagan issued a proclamation designating both Ice Cream Month and the day itself. In doing so, by the way, Reagan described ice cream as a nutritious and wholesome food which, quote, enjoys a reputation as the perfect dessert and snack food. So with all of that said, let's talk about ice cream. To do so, we welcome Jan Wichayanupar, co-owner of Valley-based Sweet Republic Artisan Ice Cream.
Phoenix is fantastic for ice cream because it is a year-round product. We slow down a little bit when school gets started. I guess that's about as much seasonality as we get and a little bit when the weather gets cold. But because we get so many out-of-towner here, 50 degree is ice cream eating weather. You're from Chicago. And then in the summer, we take a small little hit when for a week or two when the weather hits triple digit because we all take a deep breath and go, oh my God, it is hot. And everybody stays indoor. And about 2 weeks later, everybody realized we live in Phoenix. It's 100 degrees. So what?
Do people tend to stay and eat in the store more in the summer as opposed to risking their ice cream turning into soup by taking it outside?
No, actually.
Really, they risk it?
A lot of people do to drive home or to eat really quick, but I don't really see more people hanging out in the summer. Actually, I get more people hanging out in the spring when the weather's great.
Do you feel pressure to come up with unique or maybe exotic types of flavors of ice cream as opposed to just sort of having the standards?
No, not at all. That's actually part of the joy of running your own business. The pressure is actually keeping people's favorite ice cream in the case. When my business partner, Helen Young, who's a very talented ice cream chef, I have to give a shout out to her, we're coming up with flavors all the time, like every week. And the pressure is actually to hold her back and be all like, but there are flavors that people have bonded with and you can't remove them from the case and just keep on shoving in new flavors.
So how do you decide what you're going to do and what you're not going to do? I mean, how out there is too out there to try?
I think as long as it tastes good to us, it's not too out there. Like right now, in the case, we have habanero bacon avocado. And some people
really?
Might think that, yeah, that's a little out there. And, you know, it tastes good to us. I think our criteria is it has to taste good. I know Helen tends to be a little bit more cerebral about her approach to ice cream. She goes for a lot of balance and bringing in different combination of flavor profile. I tend to be a little bit more the, if it's tasty, I'm all for it.
Do you get, like, weird requests from customers? Like, hey, have you ever thought about doing this?
Yeah, we do. We get flavor requests all the time. And if it falls in line with ingredients we have on hand and stuff, we definitely give it a shot.
Jan Wichayanaparp is the co-owner of Sweet Republic Ice Cream. Jan, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, there are a lot of things going on this weekend, but after that, Mark, I think I just want to sit home and eat ice cream. So
yeah,
thanks.
I think it's going to be a cone-filled weekend, don't you think?
George Lopez, though, is in town, comedian tomorrow night at 7:30 at Celebrity Theater. I have heard George Lopez is in the running to succeed Donald Trump on The Apprentice.
Seriously?
How about that?
That would be very interesting. He's got, I don't know, who's got better hair?
I don't want to talk about
that. We should probably just leave that alone. The Diamondbacks will be hosting the San Francisco Giants this weekend at Chase Field. Evening games tonight and tomorrow, an afternoon game on Sunday.
There's a Hank Williams Senior tribute tonight at 7 at the Pebble Creek Renaissance Theater in Goodyear.
The show was produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Tracy Greer, Sky Shout, and Maria Springs are the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer, John Hoban.
We do want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. The show at KJZZ.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. We hope you have a great weekend and try to stay dry. All Things Considered is next at 3 o'clock.